Thank you. I'm going to ask you to, this is, George has talked to you about the state of the law. This is going to be a little bit of a different focus on the Affordable Care Act, and it's sort of a journey in speculation. So, or tea leaf reading, and no, I have nothing to disclose. What I want to think about are some of the impacts, the way that the Affordable Care Act may affect public health law. And for the purposes of this conversation, I want to, oh, thank you, that helps. I'm going to use a modified version of Larry Gostin's definition of public health law. He actually defines not public health law, he defines it as a field. And I actually want to think about not the field of public health law, but public health laws themselves. And so I'm going to define it as laws that seek to ensure the conditions for people to be healthy, to identify, prevent, and ameliorate risks to health in the population. A few points about this definition that should be familiar to most of you. First, it focuses on health of populations, not individuals. Second, it deals not only or primarily, in fact, with treatment, but with preventing and ameliorating risks. And third, this definition does not deal and does not encompass all laws that affect public health by any stretch of the imagination. It only affects the laws that seek to, that in some sense have an explicit purpose of ensuring the conditions for population health. So it's a small set of the universe of laws affecting public health. So what are the ACA's implications for these laws? In thinking about that, I found it useful to thinking about to going through sort of three different levels or ways in which we can think of the ACA as affecting public health law. First, there are the direct effects, the direct impacts. And by this I mean, what are the provisions of the ACA and how do these provisions, what impact might these provisions have on public health law? And again, I'm asking about their impact on public health law, not on public health, which for many of you might be the more interesting question. But second, what are the impact of the theoretical and deep structure of the ACA, the assumptions underlying it, the story it tells, because I think law also has an impact that way. And then third, what are the impacts of the legal and political consequences that the ACA has set in motion? And all of these impacts levels affect each other, but they also, I think, directly may have some impact on public health law. So I'm going to begin just very briefly talking about the direct impacts. And as many scholars have noted, the Affordable Care Act, although most overtly a law that aims at regulating the health insurance system, it is itself a public health law, and it will have important public health ramifications. The insurance provisions themselves, for example, will reduce the number of people by approximately 28 to 30 million. It will reduce the number of people who are uninsured. It will expand coverage for preventive health services, promote wellness programs, which will be discussed, which Wendy will discuss, and provide support for primary care. In addition, the ACA also has several provisions, particularly in Title IV, that we might call more directly population health provisions. For example, Congress created the Prevention and Public Health Fund, which has supported the creation of the National Prevention Strategy. There are community transformation grants, there are provisions for healthy aging, there's support for adult vaccines, there's the menu labeling law provision that is going into effect, and of course there is everybody's favorite, the tax on tanning. Now, what is the impact of these various provisions on public health law? And again, I'm not asking about their impact on public health. And so, therefore, this is all very speculative. But first, I think we can see with the ACA, an increasing trend towards the federalization of public health law. Georgia said a moment ago that we think of public health law primarily as state law. That's certainly public health law 101. But in fact, we know that the federal government has been involved in public health since the 1790s, i.e. since the beginning of its existence. And there has been an increasing trend over time of federalizing public health law. Concomitant with that, there's been an increasing trend, especially of late, to preempt and override state health laws. By having so many provisions directly applicable to public health and population health, I think we can see the ACA as really epitomizing and perhaps accelerating that trend. After all, in a sense, Congress has just passed an omnibus federal public health law bill. Second, and I think less obviously recognized, there are a lot of provisions in the ACA and in the particular provisions I've talked about that put a great reliance on obtaining evidence-based evidence for public health measures, and for example, for the community, many of the public health measures in Title IV. An interesting, and there's a lot of money for grant money for getting evidence now about the efficacy and impact of community-based interventions, as long as we know that there's more support for comparative effectiveness research on the healthcare treatment side. What will it mean if we ever actually know whether a particular intervention affects public health? We know that, for example, courts are extremely and have historically been very deferential to the cry, this is being done in the name of public health, but often they have no basis of knowing whether or not that's true. Will we start actually seeing a demand for, a reliance upon evidence in analysis of public health cases, law cases, both at the administrative law level and the agency level? I don't know, but I think that the ACA, with its support for promoting the reliance on evidence in public health law, may actually support that move. Another interesting impact, from my perspective, is I call it the emerging from the shadows of uninsurance. But I think actually a lot of our public health law only makes sense if we recognize that it has developed in a climate in which public health officials and state policymakers understood that large populations were uninsured. Consider, for example, the Ryan White Care Act. HIV comes along in the 1980s. Horrible disease, terrible epidemic then, people are dying, infectious epidemic, public health is at risk. What do? We can't assume that everyone has access to care, even though the care, of course, in the 1980s was not very effective, but we can't assume that. So what does Congress do? It creates a specific program for a specific disease. If you think about our tuberculosis laws, they also actually make sense when you realize that they're operating in a climate in which specific programs were required for specific diseases that had population impact because they were infectious, in which you couldn't assume that everyone had access to treatment. If we actually ever get to a place in this country where that is no longer the case, do we need these disease exceptional approaches, and what would that mean? Likewise, and I put here, you know, again, it's all speculation question mark, but reliance on coercion. Some of our coercive laws, for example, isolation and directly observed therapy for tuberculosis, again, arose in a situation in which we have large populations of people for whom treatment might not be otherwise readily available, people who are not necessarily into our healthcare system or well established in the healthcare system. If we have insurance for these populations, does that change the need for coercion, or does it make coercion, in fact, perhaps to some less problematic because people have access to care? I don't know, but I do think that once we start thinking about how much of our infectious disease and some of our other laws have developed because so many of our populations have lacked health insurance, we can start going on some interesting speculative routes. Let me talk a little bit about the theoretical underpinnings. Many scholars have noted that despite the fact that, as I said, the ACA is a public health law, it really, in very many ways, buys into the biomedical model. It situates treatment primarily, not at the population level, but in terms of access to specific healthcare services, screenings, you know, all the wellness visits, et cetera. In addition, the ACA, I think, probably not only it builds on, I think it actually furthers the fragmentation of our healthcare system and the segmentation of populations. It keeps a system in which there are an amazing different number of healthcare plans. People are in many groups. It actually adds to it. We now have a new thing. We have grandfathered groups and non-grandfathered groups. Okay. In addition, it presupposes that individuals have choices of plans, and it presupposes that individuals have responsibility for their health. That will come forth in the discussion of wellness plans, but the individual mandate is actually coined in the statute, a individual responsibility provision. So what does that mean? Well, we may see perhaps greater integration of healthcare law and public health law, or perhaps more likely, we may see the continuing domination of public health law by healthcare law, with the movement, again, of so much prevention. And if everyone has prevention at the clinical level, then, you know, why do we need, one could imagine people saying, public health? There's segmentation, as I talked about. What does that mean for a sense of solidarity? On the one hand, we might say that the ACA moves us towards solidarity. There's some recognition of a government responsibility for making access to care available. On the other hand, if you play through, and maybe we can talk about this in the questions, the fragmentation of the system, there's actually no party, there's no player with any skin in the game in terms of long-term or community-wide outcomes. And I'd say that despite ACOs. What does it mean in terms of liberty versus responsibility? With all the provisions about choice and responsibility, what is this going to mean for individual rights? Is there going to be a greater recognition of individual rights or a sense of you're responsible for your own health? And damn it, we're all paying for it, so you better be responsible. Now, let me talk just very briefly about the political and legal. I can't talk about the ACA without talking about its political consequences. These are some of the consequences of the law. We've seen the rise of the Tea Party, but more generally a political movement to limit the role of government, to focus on deficits, and to emphasize individual responsibility. And we now have the litigation, and I'm not going to go through the litigation because George did that very well, but I want to emphasize for a second the point that George made about the critical role that the activity and inactivity distinction plays in the litigation. So what does this mean? First of all, I would suggest decreased funding for community-based interventions and perhaps for public health law innovation. At the same time, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw an increased reliance on cheap solutions. And policymakers often love to pass a law prohibiting something rather than creating a program to ensure the conditions for people to be healthy. Well, I said increased federalization, but certainly if the litigation might push us in the other direction, to an increased devolution to the states, to this idea, and the rhetoric is there in the litigation that public health law is state law. But behind that is what I would call an increased formalism, a view of public health law that sees sharp divisions between federal and commerce, police power, between the action and inaction. In a sense, what the litigation is doing is taking us back to or raising arguments that really have not been taken seriously since the 1930s. The lawyers in this room know the Lochner era. Some of the lower courts have cited, for example, cases back from the early part of the 20th century that threw out laws prohibiting child labor. There is great danger to public health law in this move. I think that I would say that no matter how the Supreme Court rules when it takes the case, and I think we all assume it will take the case this year, the opinions, language in the opinions, whether it's a majority or a minority opinion, will give rise to further currents and doctrines that may lead to challenges for public health laws. And I don't think we can quite know where this is going to take us, but I want to suggest, maybe it's looking at it the opposite side of broccoli. Broccoli is, what could the federal government do? Well, now I'm saying, what could doctrine do? Let me throw one quick example, for example. The federal quarantine law actually, if you think about it, regulates people merely for inaction or existence. You've been exposed to something. You might have been exposed to something. You can be quarantined. You haven't voluntarily agreed to do it. So too at the state level. Public health law, and I'm going to skip this one because of the time, public health law has, in the 21st century, relies on a recognition of the interdependence of populations, the social determinants of health, and the global nature of public health. The ACA litigation is taking us back. And I'm not saying the court's going to buy this hook, line, and sinker, but it is reviving arguments and theories that have, I think, a very nostalgic and somewhat naive vision of public health. So I want to suggest, at least I'm concerned, that however the litigation is decided, that there may be some real dangers for public health law ahead. This was about, I was going to talk about the research agenda that comes out of this, and I'm happy to talk about it during the question.